I just want to let you all know we're going to start the Q&A section of this morning session in just a moment or two. There are two additional contributions to this morning panel, one of which will be included, will spill over into the afternoon session, and that's an address by former Congressman Cornelius Gallagher from New Jersey. He's 93 years old. He was involved in some of the early skirmishes of the war against this massive spying state. His battles with J. Edgar Hoover are among the subjects that he discusses in his video presentation, and we will have that later. We also have a written speech by Virginia State Senator Richard Black. He is basically a Marine, Vietnam-era combat veteran, wounded in combat, flew 269 combat missions, and he has written a paper for this conference called Syria, a case study of how the U.S. has engaged in a policy of regime change in violation of the U.S. Constitution and international law. I just want to take a moment to read just the opening and closing paragraphs of his presentation, and we will make it available to everybody. Hopefully, we'll have time to circulate it and maybe read it if there's time on the afternoon panel. He begins, he says, "Over the past several years, I've become deeply concerned about the destructive course of our foreign policy in the Middle East and Northern Africa. We have aligned ourselves with the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda jihadists against governments that afforded their population the opportunity to practice their respective religions and to live in peace with their fellow citizens." He goes next through a number of initiatives that he has taken in the absence of action by the leadership of the federal government, whether in the executive branch or in the U.S. House and in the U.S. Senate. He's written to President Assad of Syria on three occasions. He's written to General al-Sisi of Egypt. And in all of these instances, he's urged specific action against the spread of this tyranny of religious intolerance and violence that we're seeing right now playing out so dangerously in Iraq. In the concluding paragraph of his presentation, State Senator Black says, "This week, ISIL, global jihadists controlling much of Syria and Iraq, have beheaded 1,700 innocent people in Mosul, Iraq. Their armed columns are driving towards Iraq's capital, Baghdad. I've warned of arming and training jihadists, and now the chickens have come home to roost. By undermining stable Arab states and by arming and financing Al-Qaeda-linked jihadists, we have unleashed an unprecedented wave of savagery that threatens to consume the civilized world. We must find a new direction and do so quickly." Now, so on that note, I want to begin the Q&A section of this morning session. It is now 10 after 1. We plan to conclude this panel at 2 o'clock, at which point we're going to extend an invitation for everybody to experience indigestion, because we're going to try to restrict the lunch break to 1 hour, because we have many, many important messages and presentations in the afternoon. So we would really like to be able to begin promptly at 3 o'clock. So the lunch break, as we now plan it, will run from 2 to 3. I understand that Matt Ogden is here with a mobile microphone. There he is, right there. Okay, so you can see him. The first person I'm going to call on is Avin Derki, who is a spokesman for the Syrian American Forum.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks, Mrs. Hager. When everybody speak of you, I cried. I remember Syrian kids, how get killed, and they sell their organs, the terrorists in Syria. and who's supporting? America. United States government supporting the terrorists in Syria through Saudi Arabia and Turkish and Qatar. The bloodshed all over in Syria. I'm here to send a message to everyone of the United States. I'm a Syrian American. What I ask, what we waiting after Syria? Did we wait to another 11 September? Did we wait till they come here and kill our kids? Eat their heart? Eat their lover? It's a now. It's a time to move, to tell our government, stop supporting imaginated. They call it always imaginated martyr. Imaginated moderate. It's no moderate. It's everyone to hold guns in Syria, now in Iraq, is terrorists. Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, Islamic fanatic. They not a human being. They are terrorists. The only way to stop it, we have to think, how are we going to stop it? What are we going to do? What step to protect our national, our land here, to protect from the terrorists, to protect our kids, our college, our hospital, everything? We have to take steps. First steps, we have to put pressure on the Congress to stop arming the terrorists in Syria and put pressure on Saudi Arabia and Turkish and Qatar to stop sending the terrorists and money. It's a time to move. We want a peace to everybody. We here in this land to love each one, not to kill other. For money or for line pipe or anything. I'm from Syria. I'm a Kurdish. And I'm American too. I came to this country. Your tax helped my kids to study. Your tax make me live United States like my own house. I love United States and I love Syria. You're my family. I want to protect you, protect my kids, protect my grandchild. Like I want to protect everybody in the world. Help me to stop that terrorist, to put pressure to our government. At Syrian American Farm, we make a petition to put pressure on the government. I have the paper with me. Everybody sign it and spread to give to everybody to help us. Please vote to stop the terrorists in Syria. It's so important, this petition, to Syria, to protect our land here, and to give a message to Mr. Obama and the Congress and all everybody in the world and Tony Blair to tell them stop. It's enough blood. It's a time to wake up. We don't want 11 September again. We don't want cries. We don't want sadness. We don't want terrorists in our country. And it's an important thing, this message to each Congress in the United States and each president in Europe. Now a lot of people coming from Syria, as civilian, as we don't know. They come into here. The government, they stop talking to the Syrian government. Who comes to here, it's no information from Syria. Maybe Al-Nusra coming, maybe Al-Qaeda. It's an important thing to protect United States, to protect Europe. The Syrian American government has to get the relationship with Syrian government to take all the information who come in here to protect our land, our kids, our future. Thanks a lot. Thanks to have me.
I don't know if Helga or any of the panelists want to say anything on that, or just go to the first question from... This is a copy of the petition, and I assume there's copies available here in the hall.
So please raise your hand.
The floor is open.
Thank you. I would like to ask Helga, in the EU and in the NATO countries, what are the, now that they are dropping white phosphorus weapons in eastern Ukraine, I don't know if you saw that report yesterday, actual use of white phosphorus, very clear in the video, exactly like they have done in other... This is one of the greatest outrages that you could imagine. Where are the forces in political Europe that are going to rise in opposition to the U.S. policy? And obviously this is being driven by the United States. The CIA is there on the ground directing the use of white phosphorus weapons in eastern Ukraine. It's an outrage. Who are the people in Europe that are going to stand against it?
I think that the Russian ambassador in the United Nations, Churkin, has requested a special UN Security Council investigation of this. But there are a whole bunch of other atrocities, like the absolute barbarian murder of the people who were burned alive in Odessa. Then you had the... continuous slaughter of people in Slavyansk, in different East Ukrainian cities. You had the sniper attack in the Maidan around the 22nd of February. All of these things need an urgent investigation and limelight, but the scandal is that the West in general, I mean the officialdom of the governments in Europe, also naturally the United States, they have completely turned a blind eye on all of this. I mean, we have tried to raise this by inviting, for example, Natalia Vitrenko, who is a very famous economist in Ukraine. And we had organized a tour to Paris, to the Strasbourg European Parliament, and to Italy to highlight that. And, you know, we are doing as much as we can to put a limelight. But I would call on all of you, you know, because what the woman from Syria said is in the same line. I mean, there you had the most barbarian things happening, and the West is lying. And I think the professor from New York, I mean, I think it was a very important point, because the big question is, why is all of this allowed? How can it be, you know, we are only 69 years after the Second World War. And at that time, there was a clear idea, never again, never again. And what happened to that? You have Nazis running all over the place in Ukraine, being supported by the United States, being supported by the EU, being supported by the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung in Germany. And, you know, we have raised this, but I really ask all of you, I mean, the reason why we conducted this conference was not just to have a nice review of contemporary politics, but to really create a mass movement for peace. And I would really ask all of you, join. And maybe if the word never again has been used up, I think Ramsey said it, no more.
My name is Nizar Abboud. I am a Lebanese journalist who worked for a long time in zones of war. I survived the Lebanese Civil War and lived there. I've been working at the United Nations for the past 8 years. Before that, I served in London as a correspondent. I'm still a correspondent to Al-Mayadeen television in Beirut. One of the things that categorizes the current conflict in the Middle East is a shift from traditional use of protection of minorities in the area to support to the majorities against minorities. And we see some kind of ethnic cleansing happening in the region by Christians being allowed or encouraged to leave Iraq, to leave Syria, to leave Lebanon, to leave Palestine, and the Israeli-occupied territories. And the West or the superpowers seem to support this ethnic cleansing for some ulterior motives. I can interpret it, but I would like to leave that to you, to like everyone. Historically speaking, the humankind usually supports the minority against the oppression of the majority. But what we are witnessing now is the opposite. And that's something very uncharacteristic of the past, and human race should really stand against that. What's happening in Syria now, and what's happening in Iraq, and what's happening in many parts of the Arabic Peninsula, there is ethnic cleansing in Yemen, in Africa, in North Africa, in West Africa, in Central African Republic. You see ethnic cleansing, and with the support of the colonial powers, past colonial powers, who in the past came to the rescue of certain minorities, and now they encourage majorities to clean the area of the minorities. Without this coexistence between these minorities, I believe the world will be much, much more dangerous, and we will see more and more terrorism, and this will be manifested in many parts of the world. And this probably will justify future pogroms in Europe, in the rising fascist systems that we, and the elections we have seen recently. And I believe everyone should really speak against that and notice that there is some kind of mechanism used in the media in order to encourage that. In the past few decades, I was in London working, and I noticed that in the early 80s, the Saudis invested huge amounts of money in the media. And they continue to do so with the Qatari, with the petrodollar, of course, flowing, and with the instructions and directions from others. They are really have influenced the public opinion. And we saw that during the so-called Arab Spring, when Al Jazeera, which was usually seen as an impartial media, became totally provocative, totally insightful of violence and uprisings here and there, spreading misinformation, other channels like Al Arabiya, and of course publications everywhere, that things really went. These media became like political parties playing a role of changing what's happening there. And this is something else that should be really scrutinized. The media is not impartial anymore. Even the media here, they cover up a lot of things. They keep you in the dark. And that's why many, many people are turning to social media in order to learn more. They want to see for themselves the videos which are uploaded on YouTube or on Facebook. They'll go to Twitter to hear someone talking from Mosul or from Damascus or from other places, because they don't trust the media anymore. And for those who continue to trust the media, they are totally misinformed. Again, a lot of people now, the majority in this society, I think, they don't care about the news anymore. And they have lost probably this sense of that they should know what's going on, and they should learn earlier about the dangers that could cause or anything that may affect their future lives, such as a terrorist attack or not. They just trust that the politicians know everything, and they turn to music and to entertainment. And that's another big danger, I think, which is engineered. It's not happening coincidentally. I hope I manage. Of course, there are a lot of things as a journalist to say about the United Nations here, which really resonates or repeats only what it is being told. United Nations was created to bring about a new world order, that really can stand to be some kind independent, trustworthy, but unfortunately, what we see, for example, from the Secretary General of the United Nations is that he waits until something is issued by the White House, and then he issues a similar statement, identical in its content. That's very dangerous. I wish I was helping.
I'd like... Thank you. back in 2011, as the events in Libya were playing out, it was very striking, and Mr. LaRouche commented at the time, number one, that a fundamental principle of the United Nations, which was a certain kind of honest and trusting deliberation among the at least the five permanent members of the Security Council, was absolutely breached when Susan Rice swore up and down that this was a humanitarian, quote-unquote, intervention and not about regime change. And as the result of that, people may remember that both Russia and China abstained on the resolution for limited use of force. And, of course, they were lied to. The intent from the beginning was regime change. And so you have a system at the United Nations that has been fundamentally destroyed and broken as the result of that. And the speed with which Gaddafi was summarily executed prompted Mr. LaRouche at that time to say that we are headed for a short-term crisis that will be much bigger than Libya. The real targets here are Russia and China. And that's the crisis that we find ourselves facing now. I wanted to ask if any of the panelists, Helga and others, would want to comment on what the last remarks were and then take the next question.
I want people to also go on our website where we have a dossier about this whole NGO apparatus, because that is one of the reasons, you know, why we conducted this conference also in New York, because we want to have a limelight that the United Nations is covering up for some of these terrorist NGOs. We actually call them the no good organizations. and I don't know what the appropriate venue is. Maybe you can help us to find that. But you know, I think it's a scandal when you know when NGOs are being used to destabilize countries around the world, which the Russian government has by now declared to be an undeclared state of war, that the United Nations should harbor these organizations. And you know, I do not. I mean, maybe there is an honest NGO somewhere. I haven't found it yet, you know. But absolutely. Also, in the case of Egypt, the Egyptian government at a certain point banned a whole bunch of NGOs because they were meddling in the internal affairs of the country. So I think, you know, since we want to stop these colored revolutions, and since the NGOs are one of the main vehicles to prepare the ground, and they go hand in glove with the military operation which then follows, you know, I think we should make a motion in the United Nations that these bodies should be investigated, and if they are not genuine and if they are not doing what they are supposed to do but are a cover for something else, they should be also closed down.
I think both Wayne Mattson and Ray McGovern wanted to also make some comments on the...
I guess I'm looking for someone to mention the word Israel. I mean, hello. What are Israel's interests here with respect to Syria and, you know, by devolution, American interests, because we seem to be tied to the Israelis on these issues? Just mentioned in passing, Egypt. There wasn't a coup there? I guess there wasn't a coup. Must have been called something else, because we wanted to be able to give military aid to Egypt so that they could get rid of Morsi and set up a government that's much more susceptible to Israeli influence. That's the name of the game. Now, on Syria, I found it really interesting because of the extreme bias of U.S. media, and particularly the Zionist influence in U.S. media, that creeping into the New York Times account of what was going on in Syria was a report by Judy Ruderin, the New York Times bureau chief in Jerusalem. This was the 6th of September, the same day that we, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, wrote a memorandum to the president saying, hey, don't be deceived here. It wasn't the Syrian government that released these chemical weapons. It was the rebels. We knew that because our former colleagues told us that. And later, General Dempsey learned that and turned that around. So what did Judy Ruderin say? Well, here's what she said. The title was, Israel Backs Limited Strike Against Syria. Again, September 6, 2013. Quote, for Jerusalem, the status quo, horrific as it may be from a humanitarian perspective, seems preferable to either a victory by Mr. Assad's government or a strengthening of rebel groups increasingly dominated by Sunni jihadists. Bear in mind, this time last year, Assad was beginning to win. He had driven some of the rebels out of their strongholds. The tide was turning. Something had to be done. From the Israeli perspective, nothing better than U.S. military involvement. And they had a handle there, the red line. Somebody had persuaded Obama to say, oh, red line, if chemical weapons are used, I'll have to reassess the whole thing. So here's what Ruderin says. This is a playoff situation. She's quoting the former Israeli consul general in New York. Okay? Quote, this is what he says. This is a playoff situation in which you need both teams to lose. But at least you don't want one of them to win. We'll settle for a tie, he said. Let them both bleed. Let them hemorrhage to death. That's the strategic thinking here. As long as this lingers, there's no real threat from Syria to Israel. Now, if that's their calculation, and people like John Kerry, let's face it, he's a neocon from the day one, if we are carrying out their bidding, that's the problem here, folks. It should be acknowledged. We should not blanch before it.
I just have an anecdotal comment in response to the gentleman who was talking about the bias in the media. I guess we're not too far from the New York Times here. Maybe they'll hear this. I've never worked for the New York Times. I will never work for the New York Times. I don't want to work for the New York Times. I happen to be in Tripoli, Libya during the NATO bombing campaign against Gaddafi. I was staying in the Corinthian Hotel, which is at the seafront. 1 kilometer away was the Rixos Hotel, where most of the foreign journalists were staying, including the New York Times perennial war correspondent, John Burns. I'm sitting in my hotel room reading dispatches from Mr. Burns from Tripoli, and he's talking about schools are closed, shops are closed, the streets are empty. And I'm reading this, and I'm hearing car horns beeping outside my window, unarmed policemen directing traffic. Seeing schoolgirls on their way to school. I don't know what Tripoli he was in. Maybe he was in Tripoli, Lebanon, but I happen to be in Tripoli, Libya, 1 kilometer away. It is clear that he wasn't reporting what. And now, how often do you read something from the New York Times and you just happen to be in the same place to basically say this guy's full of BS on this? I mean, that was the case in Tripoli, and I was able to basically look at Burns's war dispatches, and they were absolutely patently false. And then CNN and Al Jazeera, they were doing the same thing, misreporting these wars. So we go to war based on false news stories. That violates every canon of journalism there is. And of course, this profession that I'm in, I'm afraid, is becoming like television repairmen and travel agents. It's just not what I intended to see happen with the profession. But that's just one example, and I'm sure we can go back and look in history, Vietnam, and you know, other wars, Afghanistan, Iraq. It's probably the same thing. But that was my own personal experience in basically saying the New York Times is absolutely wrong in reporting on this. So I just wanted to let you know that.
Good afternoon. My name is Lieutenant Commander Kenneth Goldstein. I'm coming on in 27 years in active service in the United States Coast Guard. I work for the Veterans Department. I also work with a gentleman called Ali North. I'm sure you know him. He's a Fox correspondent who still works basically for another agency that I won't mention due to security reasons. We all know that the media feeds us what they want us to think is the truth. I'm a veteran of five wars, starting from Grenada, Panama, going into the bombing of Lampedusa from Libya, going into three tours in Iraq, one in Saudi Arabia. What I do want to mention is that our government is the worst enemy to us. They will not ever tell us the truth. Reason being that it is not a power issue, is that the American people, if they ever knew what our government is doing to our people and to the people for other countries, basically, what we need to do is to take our power back from them. If this was 100 years ago, everybody in Congress and the Senate would be taken out back and shot for treason. And basically is what they should be done right now. A month ago, a lot of people don't know this, but there was a chemical attack in the UN to several Latin ambassadors to their staff. They experienced nosebleeds, hair falling out of their head. The CDC was aware of it, but it was never released to the public. It was never released to the media. Two employees died already. Two more are now being affected. They're actually at the hospital now being treated for this. The UN, in my opinion, should be dismantled, thrown into the East River, and they are not serving the purpose that they were intended for. They basically are non-effective at this point. None of the programs that they had set up are being used anymore, especially the one that for the children that they had basically set up. Anything that comes out of the UN basically counteracts any good. I feel bad for the secretary that's in charge of the UN at this point, because his job is useless. Any resolution that he tries to bring forward for peace for the world, nobody's interested in listening to for peace. As a military officer, I have taken orders that I had to basically stomach, because I didn't agree with them, but I had to do my duty. And there are times where I had disobeyed some direct orders. I had told my command I said that these are lawful orders, but I'm taking them under duress because of what I had seen in Panama, just like our gentleman had said before, that these bodies were being killed and being covered up, but not just there. But think about what happened in Croatia, and think about what happened in Bosnia, ethnic cleansing, millions of people, and also in Saudi Arabia. and look in what happened in Iraq. Look what happened in Syria. You have people that have been killed just for the sake of believing in God. Their belief is different than somebody else. They get murdered. This has to stop. And Helga, when she brought up the point, you know, she has realized that this is not just international, but this is in the United States. We are being attacked internally. And this is part of the problem that a lot of people don't realize, that, yes, this administration has to go. And this is the most important thing that we here have to realize, that not only does this administration are the biggest bunch of liars and totally disobeying every directive, every order that the Constitution, our Bill of Rights have been violated to date, they have no regard for our rights as a country that was founded by our founding fathers. But as of today, this man that's in office, he should be shot for treason because he does not believe in our Constitution. And we have the right as an American people to take him out of office. We don't have to wait for Congress to do that.
Yeah, let me mention, back about a year ago, it was actually around, I believe, the time that Ray McGovern was speaking, around September of last year, there was a press conference convened by Congressman Walter Jones, who you heard a few moments ago addressing this conference. It was attended, I was privileged to be one of the speakers, along with Colonel Larry Wilkerson, who also sends greetings to this event today. He said this is a subject that is very near and dear to his heart, this idea of a world without war. And also Attorney Bruce Fein, who spoke at earlier Schiller Institute events here in New York City and elsewhere. And one of the points that they made is that the founders, in their wisdom, gave Congress three critical responsibilities very consciously aimed at putting a check against the potential for runaway powers by the executive branch. Number one, Congress was given the exclusive authority to go to war. Number two, Congress was given the exclusive authority to generate credit. And number three, and perhaps most importantly, Congress was given the authority to impeach a president. And the founders, in their discussions in Philadelphia and in the Federalist Papers and elsewhere, said that they actually expected that a president would be impeached about once every generation, because they said the powers that are being given to the president, even with the enormous checks and balances of the legislative branch and the courts, is still so tempting that invariably certain people will succumb. And what they said at that press conference, and I think this is the message that rings true here, is that the failure of Congress to live up to those awesome responsibilities that were given to them by the founders has created the crisis. We wouldn't be talking about the Obama issue if it hadn't been the case that Bush and Cheney were spared impeachment for the crimes that they committed, bringing the country to war on the basis of lies, some of which were conjured in a foreign capital, Tony Blair's London. And so one of the issues that we really have to strive for and fight for, and one of the purposes of this conference, is to hold elected officials' feet to the fire. And until that happens, we're in an election year. We're in a period of tremendous ferment among the people of this country. One of the Wall Street icons of Capitol Hill, Eric Cantor, was defeated last Tuesday in a landslide defeat. Keisha Rogers, who will be giving the keynote in the afternoon panel, was given 28% of the vote in a statewide Texas Democratic primary several weeks back. I say given 28% because every indication that we have is that outside of Cook County, Texas has the southern franchise on vote fraud, and that her actual vote totals were substantially higher than that. But she campaigned for reinstatement of Glass-Steagall and for Obama's impeachment for a whole series of issues, including the illegal war that was carried out in Libya. So we have a few more questions. We are going to stick to our schedule time-wise. And so let's take the next question. And I'd ask people, because we only have a brief period of time left, to ask questions to the members of the panel. Keep it short so we have a maximum time for dialogue. Sorry, go ahead. Yes.
Hi, this is a question for Wayne Madsen. As a young person, I actually aspire to be a journalist, a political analyst journalist, but I was curious, like, how do you propose that we would end up changing the profession of journalism and being able to expose some of the big problems with our nation, such as the NSA and all of the things that happen to be covered up? Like, how would you propose something like that would change, and how it would affect our nation to be able to change journalism and therefore share more for our citizens?
Well, I don't want to sound too jaundiced about the profession, but I encourage, I've even told people who are getting ready to graduate from high school and thinking about taking journalism in college to do it. The media is changing. We've been through these cycles before in journalism when we went from print to radio and then radio to television. And now we're just coming into a different type of medium. It basically is going to be, and what it is already, is a journalist has to be a master at all different types of media. They call it mojo, mobile journalism. You not only have to do the print, you've got to be familiar with, you know, the web, getting your story online, try to beat the competitors, but also there's a lot of people that don't like to read anymore. They want to see it on YouTube. So you've got to be familiar with the camera. And you can actually, you don't need a camera person. You can do it yourself with a tripod and a camera. And you see a lot of journalists doing this now. So now, you know, it's radio, it's video, it's print, it's web. Now the bad news. What does this pay? be prepared for a steady diet of tuna fish, baked beans, because it doesn't pay all that well. However, there are a lot of websites that are getting started, and some have been around already. I mean, some are better than others. I think the future will be, as we see the miniaturization of these mobile devices, there'll still be a need for journalists, good journalists, because you're going to have to be able to separate the nonsense out there on the internet from real journalism. So I still encourage people to get into it, but the money is an issue. I think the average 10 newspapers in this country fold every year, no pun intended. They're going out of business. There are some new forms of journalism we see in regional areas where the newspapers are now cooperating with the local public television stations and other organizations to bring regional news to the people, and that gets into international and national as well, not just regional. So this is a new dynamic we're seeing, and they do have money. I'll give you the example of St. Petersburg, Florida, with the Poynter Institute basically runs the Tampa Bay Times. That's a nonprofit that cooperates very closely with the public television stations. So this is what we're seeing as a way to get out of the trash journalism we see on Fox and CNN and MSNBC and the probably soon to be gone, three major network news broadcasts. I don't think we'll have NBC, ABC, and CBS news broadcasts in about 5 years. I think they'll be replaced by reruns of Seinfeld. Something important. Oh, and I got into media. What's been happening with the media. I wrote this book a few years ago. It's still available on the Internet. It's Overthrow a Fascist Regime on $15 a Day. That was basically my budget in Washington during the dark days of the Bush administration, $15 a day. Was it successful? Well, I don't know. I mean, Bush left office a very kind of bitter man. Now he's painting pictures of himself in the bathtub. So, you know, there is hope.
I'm also a journalist. That is, I broke with it because it was so disgusting that I knew I would lose my soul completely if I would stay, even if I had a very prominent offer by Spiegel at that time. But I think the way to look to rechange journalism is to destroy the empire. Because what is wrong with the international media in the so-called Western world is they are completely owned by Wall Street, by the City of London, by the big banking system. If Goebbels would be alive and take a peek today, he would be absolutely furious because they out-Goebbeled Goebbels. And that was the program what the British intelligence decided after World War II, that they would study how Goebbels used the propaganda machine and do better. And they have indeed, you know, sophisticated that, like the NSA sophisticated the surveillance of Hoover, they have sophisticated the manipulation. As a matter of fact, you know, 70% of all articles today in the main media or main features are not written by journalists. They're written by public relation firms who have only one intention, how to manipulate the axioms of belief of the readers. They're not trying to tell the truth. They're trying to campaign and change the belief structure of the people. So the moment you start to be part of that, you lose your soul. So don't become a journalist until we have destroyed the empire, and help us to do that, and then become a journalist afterwards.
I just wanted to say a word about the Constitution of the United States. I have a copy right here. I keep it with me. It's not obsolete, and it's not quaint, but there are a lot of people who think of it as quaint and obsolete. And you have to, in my view, realize that it's both major political parties that have this disdain for the Constitution. I mean, that's clear. Look what our president, look at his disdain for the Fourth Amendment, for the Fifth Amendment, for the First Amendment. You name them, okay? Now, 8 years ago, we had midterm elections, just like we're going to have this year. And who won? The good guys, the Democrats, okay? Now, our president had been and our vice president had been guilty of wars of aggression and, you know, a whole list of impeachable crimes, some of which were the same crimes for which the House Judiciary Committee, on which John Conyers served, had served up articles of impeachment against President Nixon. So what happens this time around? Cindy Sheehan and I make an appointment with John Conyers, and we get in to see him. And he doesn't seem to be at all interested in impeaching the president. And we were, okay? So at one point, I said, now, Congressman Conyers, don't you think that starting wars like Bush and Cheney have done, isn't that impeachable offense? He said, well, I said, are you going to move? He said, well, nothing says in the Constitution that I have to impeach Bush. I said, well, aren't you chair of the Judiciary Committee now that you've won the election? Yes. But we couldn't get the votes to impeach. Oh, come on, I said. And his lawyers, you know, about five lawyers there. You know, like, nobody talks to a congressman like that, you know? And so I said, you know, you really need to go ahead and do that because that's your duty under the Constitution. It's right here, you know? And he said, no, that's not it. Nancy Pelosi says that if we... No, that's what he said. Nancy Pelosi says that if we appear to be divisive or even divisive, we won't win big enough in the next election. And I said, come on, give me a break. You're putting political considerations ahead of the Constitution of the United States? He said, well, nothing says in there that I have to. So we wouldn't leave. We were arrested. I went to trial, and I'm proud that the only time they actually convicted me was this time when I was convicted of unlawful assembly or something like that when they kicked me out of there.
We have time for one more brief question before we wrap up this session.
Hi, everyone. My name is William. I'm new to this stuff, and I just got into it. I was really woken up to all this stuff fairly recently. But I think some things, like the fine fellow over there said, about the media and how it might be manipulated and actually is manipulated a lot of the time. I want to address a question towards you guys and maybe more so towards Maxim, because he works with like the digital area of like reality and stuff. So my question is, what is your institution doing for net neutrality, if you guys know what that is, and how we can continue to have a neutral internet? Because in this day and age, the internet, for example, for someone like me, a young kid, it was how I found out about all these surreptitious tactics that the government uses and that other people like behind the scenes are using against the people. So I want to know how we're going to be able to maintain net neutrality, because as you guys or people who don't know, if there is no net neutrality, then certain websites will be slowed down access to. Certain websites won't be accessible anymore. Certain websites will be torn down as soon as they send some sort of information of dissent. That's my question to you guys.
Well, let's go back to 2008 when candidate Barack Obama was asked about net neutrality. He said he was in favor of it. What net neutrality is that it's universal access to people on the internet, same speed, same bandwidth, same access. And heretofore, the Federal Communication Commission has regulated broadcast, but not cable. Now, because they're coming together, the media, the backbone for the internet, it's broadcast, but it's also cable. What we've seen is two FCC chairs appointed by Obama have basically been industry shills. Jenna Chalsky, who was, I believe, his roommate at Harvard, was the first FCC chair. And now it's a different one, but they both have basically said they want to allow the internet service providers, the Verizons and companies like that, to give high-speed preference to Netflix and other video streaming companies. So what they're creating is a like we see in a lot of highways, interstate highways. You got the HOV lane or the toll, which you pay a toll sometimes for access to these lanes. They have gone from HOV lanes, which you had more than two or three passengers. Now they're going to toll lanes where you have to pay money to access those lanes. And it's no different with the internet. So, Netflix has the money to pay the providers for the high-speed bandwidth service. And if you don't have the money, it's pay to play. You will be forced down to the second, third, fourth levels of internet access, down there with the people that are marketing Viagra and, water filters and all kinds of other stuff. So that's what's going to happen to the independent websites out there, those who don't put out the propaganda du jour. And that's unfortunately what's going to happen. The FCC is taking comments. I believe they're still taking public comments right now. But believe me, are they going to listen to the public comments, or are they going to listen to the lobbyists for Netflix and these big infotainment companies? You can figure out which way they're going to go with that. I'm afraid that, it's another lie, a broken campaign promise by Mr. Obama on the net neutrality issue. So what we're going to see is your favorite independent website or blog or whatever you you're gonna probably either have a hard time accessing those sites, or they will just disappear altogether from the internet because they won't be able to pay to compete with the big corporations that will pay for that access. That's what's happening with net neutrality. It's a shame, but. Many of us predicted that was going to happen, but the FCC has become totally politicized. So a regulator for the public interest is now promoting private corporation profits over the interests of the public.
Sounds a lot like Roman bread and circus. I've asked Helga to wrap up this morning session with just a few closing words, and as I say, we will break, and I'd like everybody to be back here for the start of the afternoon session as close to 3 o'clock as possible.
I want to just say that as important as the discussion on the media and the internet is, it is relatively minuscule compared to the other issues we discussed. Now, there is a study about denial, there are people who are living immediately under a dam say, what dam? Even if the dam breaks, then everybody will drown. And, I think that is a little bit what is reflected in the discussion because, we have a situation where we are on the verge of World War III. We are on the verge of a financial blowout of the system. And there is a remedy. And the remedy is that the large countries in the world, Russia, China, India, are moving in a completely different direction. Now, we have in the afternoon several addresses which speak about that, and I think we are not here only to discuss complaints about the status quo, but we are also here to discuss the solutions, and because there is a way out. There is no reason to be terrified like a rabbit in front of the snake, but that we have solutions, but these solutions will be only implemented if we get a fighting movement of people who are implementing it. Now, what is required, and I want to say this very briefly, what is required is a complete, drastic change in thinking, a complete paradigm shift, a new paradigm where we consciously say no to the entire paradigm associated with globalization, oligarchy, and empire. And what we need is a break which must be as fundamental as the break between the Middle Ages and modern times, for which, among others, Nicolaus of Cusa, Brunelleschi, and the contemporaries are standing for. And they have given us an example that you can totally break with a wrong paradigm. In that time, it was the scholastics, it was the neo-peripatetics, the Aristotelians, and, people who dominated the thinking at that time. And these people like Cusa, they created a new paradigm which led to the modern time of science, of culture, of art. And what we need today is a new paradigm where we say goodbye to these kinds of ugly greediness, greed, empire thinking, the dance around the golden calf, an economic system which is killing people. That's also what Pope Francis emphasized. And we need a new paradigm which looks into the future of mankind for the next 100 or the next 1,000 years. And I think that in the afternoon we should also spend a lot of time to discuss that.
I want to thank everyone who participated in this panel and look forward to seeing all of you at 3 o'clock this afternoon.